everybody. This is Mike Van Meter, and welcome to the Recovery is Possible podcast. And I want to thank you for joining me, and you can reach us at our Facebook site, which is also called Recovery is Possible, or our website, which is vanmeterwellnesssolutions.com. And this podcast exists to educate the public about addiction, remove the stigma associated with addiction, and offer help and support to those suffering from addiction. And I want to introduce you to our great sponsor. This episode is sponsored by FHE Health, and they're based in Florida. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Treatment Center, specializing in treatment for first responders' needs, including PTSD, anxiety, and substance use. So take the first steps to a better life today by visiting FHEhealth.com. And so today, I have a guest, a good friend, Rich Gerling, and he is out in Oregon. And, you know, we met through a series of acquaintances, and not the least of which is Susanna Hasney. And if you have not had a chance to listen to her appearance on this podcast, it was early this last year. Susanna Hasney was on there, and she talked about resilience, and that's what we're going to be talking to Rich about. I met Rich through Susanna. And Richard is he works in health, humanity, and performance, or he is health and humanity and performance coach, and a consultant and trainer. And he's a certified mindfulness trainer, retired police officer, and military veteran who believes in our innate resilience, the humanity and capacity to show up and thrive amidst hard circumstances, which is so important for the topic of recovery. And we've talked about that in many of our episodes. And Rich also specializes in training health resilience and human performance skills for first responders and other high reliability professionals. But a lot of the concepts that he is going to talk about applies to everybody, not just people in my former profession and his former profession, but for all of us. You know, resiliency is just so important. And so one of the things that Rich currently did was become certified with a therapy canine named Buddha, and they work together as a team to help people. They are a registered therapy team, and he's going to talk to us a bit more about that. So with that, Rich, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Mike, really great to be here with you, man.
Yeah, I hope I didn't butcher your introduction too much, but you got a lot going on. And I know I didn't even touch a fraction of what it is that you do. So tell us a bit more about what it is that you do.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned kind of this innate capacity for resilience, innate capacity even for goodness, right? And I think human beings are just badass. You know, they're remarkable. Every single person has such amazing capacity, and I don't know how often any of us ever really touch into the majority of that capacity. So what I do is I try to support people in discovering how to tap into that capacity for resilience. And this word resilience is it's fatigued. You know, I think we're overusing it. It emerged kind of as a cutting edge word maybe 15, 20 years ago, and since then we've done a lot of lip service to it, right? And but the space that I train within resilience is around training, you mentioned humanity. It's really training mindfulness skills to support humanity and to support optimal health and optimal human performance. And human performance, you know, we often think of, oh, that's some sort of, you know, sexy kind of performance thing. You know, I'm an athlete, or I'm a tactical operator, or I'm a, you know, performer in entertainment world or something. And really, performance is sometimes just getting out of the rack in the morning and showing up, right? Sometimes it's just how we engage in those routine interactions with other human beings, whether they're human beings in our family, in social circles, or whether they're strangers that we encounter, where we're all wearing masks and all we can see is the fold of their eyes, you know? Yeah. Mindfulness skills is a set of skills about training attention and compassion that is sort of my specialty, combined with some psychoeducation about growth mindset and health and wellness.
Yeah. And that's so important. Now, right now, who's your main clientele?
You know, it's interesting. That's a hard question to answer. So I wear a number of hats. I work for a number of different organizations. And the first one I want to mention is Pacific University. Pacific University is a private college out here in Oregon, just on the west side of Portland. And we have a graduate school of psychology there. faculty at the graduate school, and we have a mindful health and resilience lab, and that's run by Dr. Mike Christopher and a whole team of amazing people. And we have been researching outcomes of training mindfulness skills to police officers specifically for about the last 10 years. And I do a lot of work there. We just wrapped up a training cycle. We're in the middle, actually in the end of a National Institutes of Health funded five-year study training mindfulness to police officers in Oregon, New Mexico, and Wisconsin. And we're about ready to do kind of a final round of training this spring, in March and April for that. So that's one client, if you will. Another client is I also, once a year, I teach a leadership ethics course, which is an interesting course, at Portland State University in their criminal justice program, the Hatfield School of Government. And I also am part of a project that just got off the ground in West Virginia. And this is probably taking the most of my time right now. West Virginia University and Marshall University, we are training a series of mindfulness training and researching outcomes, training mindfulness to frontline healthcare workers, behavioral health workers, police officers and firefighters, and that kicks off next month. The actual training kicks off next month. And then, of course, I have some work I do with tactical teams with the FBI. And I also have a number of other law enforcement clients that I work with and some corporate clients that I work with.
Okay. And you got into this field. You were in the Coast Guard, correct? And then you were a police officer after that, and you retired from that. What was it in your line of work that brought you to this point? How did you get interested in this?
Yeah, it's funny. I had a conversation a couple of days ago with a friend of mine who's been a long time Coast Guard leader, and she's about ready to make a transition to retire out and do some other things. And we joked about how the Coast Guard has made us contrarians. And you know, one of the things that I so appreciate about my experience as both an enlisted kid and then later an officer in the U.S. Coast Guard was that the Coast Guard demanded that you thought differently and that you assessed process. And it's this whole quality assurance, you know, maybe, but also not being too bureaucratic about it. So I learned how to critique systems and how to look at systems and find weaknesses and find maybe better ways to do things. And so I took that skill as a Coast Guard leader into policing. And it wasn't, you know, 3 or 4 years into my police career after I got done, you know, having fun, driving fast, doing the things that young cops like to do, that I realized that there was some deeply flawed system problems within policing in America. And one of those, I think really the building blocks of some of those flaws really were grounded in the health and wellness, or said differently, the lack of health and wellness. Even more specifically, the high frequency of trauma injury and the unmitigated trauma injuries among police officers that deeply impacted, you know, the quality of police culture and the quality of our ability to show up and service the communities, and created a lot of problems. So I started searching as a young police sergeant for some kind of training that would help us to perform better. And by perform better, I meant really the social performance. And that led me down a path of 2 or 3 years of study of a lot of different disciplines. And I landed on the science of the mind-body connection, and or what's often referred to as the discipline of interpersonal neurobiology, which Dr. Dan Siegel out of UCLA sort of pioneered along with some other pretty brilliant medical professionals, and really diving into, well, what happens to the body when it's under stress? What happens to the body when it's stress injured and trauma injured? And how do we work with that? How do we train greater elasticity, if you will, or, you know, greater resilience among police officers so that we can show up day in and day out and bear witness to the suffering of human beings and skillfully provide some kind of intervention? And that led me to mindfulness. And I didn't like mindfulness at first. I resisted mindfulness at first. I took a fair amount of training in it, and ultimately realized, wow, okay, there's something about the skill of self-awareness and self-regulation that is incredibly powerful. And fast forward, I connected up with Dr. Mike Christopher at Pacific University and some others, and we built a curriculum model that we, you know, it's fluid, it's evolved, it's shifted, but, you know, we continue to use to this day.
Well, and for those that think, well, this is just information that applies to police officers and military people, we could actually extrapolate this out and say that if there's a lot of application to everybody, right? I mean, because we all go through trauma. What if, you know, people that have been, you know, suffered sexual trauma or physical trauma, gone through stressful event? I mean, a lot of the information you're talking about has application across the board, doesn't it?
Oh, there's no question, you know, and I think there is such common ground in our trauma experience of being human beings walking the planet Earth. And, you know, trauma in context has differences, but trauma in the response that we all have as these remarkable human machines is pretty much the same. And so what's really interesting is when we train a social worker alongside a police officer, you know, alongside a teacher, we start to see how we can all see each other differently, you know, and actually see each other as more human than maybe we thought before, because maybe we didn't know enough about that profession or that person. But there is such common ground in the trauma experience. And I think even now, you know, the trauma experience, the collective trauma of the pandemic is a very real thing.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, we all suffer together, and there's predictable similarity to how we respond to that pandemic trauma, much less, you know, parenting can be, and not saying parenting is traumatic, but parenting is stressful. And if you have, your kiddo has medical complications, right? Or behavioral health complications. Now we're moving into the space of, well, maybe you're not a police officer or a firefighter, but you're experiencing sustained stress and trauma that, you know, the skills that we teach to cops are as useful to parents with kids who have, you know, children in that category are also helped by those skills. And, you know, it's interesting. I'm doing a project in Flint, Michigan with the CRIM Fitness Institute, which is a remarkable nonprofit in Flint, Michigan. And Flint is one of a handful of cities that is doing a mindful initiative. So there's this Mindful Flint initiative. So they're really integrating mindfulness and yoga and other mind-body trainings into their community there. And we're working on this project where we're training a group of African-American community leaders and a group of police officers from Flint, Michigan. We haven't started training yet, but this has been in planning for a year and a half, and we're, COVID's choked us out a little bit, but we're ready to proceed here soon. But the goal is to teach police officers and some skills in mindfulness, and to teach some Black community leaders and skills in mindfulness, and then come together at the end of that and see if the mindfulness skills allow us to see each other with greater humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear each other, you know. So I think that everyone has some kind of an experience of difficulty in their life. And, you know, in fact, I don't know that any of us as humans can move through the arc of our lifetime without trauma of some sort. And so I think part of the issue, you know, is that we dramatize trauma so much. We bring so much drama with it. And, you know, we change the tone of our voice and our inflection, and we have, you know, special soft words that we use, and I just reject all of that. We just need to have valid, scientifically valid, gritty, real conversations about trauma, and just normalize it. And then, you know, it's like, okay, you're not special that you experienced this, so let's work with it. Now, of course, some people are going to hear that and feel like I'm not a kind person. That's not it at all. It's that we, I think, immobilize so many people by the narrative around trauma that we facilitate maladaptive responses to it. And I think that part of what we're doing with this notion of resilience and this notion of mindfulness is becoming more awake to what's happening in our mind and our body. And sometimes that's becoming more awake to the discomfort. And some of that discomfort is injury. And once we see it and feel it and learn how to be in it, then we get to move through it. Then we get to seek intervention, which means, you know, going to our medical professionals, going to you know, which includes, you know, psychotherapy and all kinds of, you know, integrated medical interventions. But we get to confront and work with our experience rather than try to move away from it.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. And I've got a few follow-up questions for you here, if you don't mind. But let me just talk about my sponsor one more time. And this episode is sponsored by FHE Health. FHE Health has been providing life-changing behavioral health services for more than 20 years. They treat substance abuse and mental health disorders in an individualized and comprehensive approach. Recognizing the specialized treatment needs of the first responder community, they've created Shatterproof, which is a dedicated program for law enforcement, fire rescue, and similar communities to receive treatment among their peers. And they're experienced in providing privacy and working with unions for employment. So FHE Health is committed to providing the best care experience for their patients, for their families, and for our communities. So learn more at FHEhealth.com. So Rich, you and I, prior to coming on the air here, we were talking about how, you know, trauma, but you and I were talking about addiction in general and how people don't openly talk about addiction issues. But yet it's all around us. I know in our professions, in law enforcement, in the military, alcohol abuse in particular was all over the place. But it's the one thing that, you know, people just don't want to openly talk about. And what I have found in my world when you're talking about trauma is when people come into a treatment facility like where I'm working right now, or into an AA meeting, NA meeting, you know, any type of a 12-step meeting, you never hear people talk about how good their life is. What you hear them talk about is the trauma that they're going through, or the different, you know, just horrible experiences that they're having, and then wanting to check out from that and numb the pain from that particular trauma. And what you hear on a routine basis is, you know, what I learned in coming to these meetings or coming to treatment is I'm not the only one that's going through this. And that seems to be an epiphany for people that, you know, I thought I was the only one that was going through this or had this sort of trauma. And I'm finding that I'm not. And there's something therapeutic about having shared experiences with others. And it's almost magical when people can open up and realize that there are others that are on the same journey that they are. But why is it that it takes people getting to the point to where their lives are falling apart and they become so desperate that they go out and seek help that's when they finally get well, when in reality we can preempt that? I mean, and if you would maybe, you know, talk about why that is and what it is that we can do to start dealing with these issues before we get to the point where our lives are falling apart. Because we don't have to fall apart, do we?
No, you know, and I would say, Mike, I would offer some response to that that's really just grounded in my own observation, my own mm-hmm. experience. So, you know, I'm not a clinician, right? So I can only speak to what I know. And here's I think maybe what might be helpful as a response. I think it's really simple. I think it's shame, and I think it's blame and guilt. And those three things are powerful forces that shape our behaviors. Really what they shape before our behaviors, they shape the inner narrative of ourself. And if I have, let's say I'm misusing alcohol, and let's say I'm a police leader, I'm a police lieutenant, for example, and I'm misusing alcohol, and you know, maybe I've been diagnosed with a disease. Maybe I haven't. Maybe I've never even talked to a medical professional about that. But I'm misusing alcohol so much that, you know, I'm still sort of functional at work, right? But I'm at that pivot point where it's not long before I'm going to do something that is going to make my misuse of alcohol visible to my employers. And let's say that happens. And there is a deep pool of shame that's building up, and there's a deep negative self evaluation happening during that whole time, you know, leading up to sort of the crisis event, right? Where now it's exposed. Oh, this is what I am, right? And I think that one of the things we don't teach is how to hold compassion for yourself And one of the things that we is similar to that, that we don't teach is the science behind maladaptive stress responses and what drives us predictably to misuse of alcohol and other substances, and other behaviors that do not serve us well, right? And so we identify so deeply with the judgment that we feel other people are going to have for us. And some do. So make no mistake, there are some people who judge others in really terrible ways, no matter what. But then we self-loathe, and there's all of the shame that builds upon our own negative inner narrative, and it becomes habitual. We start to, everything about ourselves that we think is wrapped in this dark inner narrative, which gets wrapped in our behaviors, which, it, you know, at the end of the day, makes us really not very skillful as we move through life. So why would I want to confront this disease of addiction if I feel so deeply ashamed? Mm-hmm. I want to avoid that at all costs, right? What's interesting about that is that one of the skills we're teaching with mindfulness is to pay attention to what's emerging, not only in our inner narrative, so the languaging that we have that spins within our, our thought narrative, our default mode network, if you will, if you want to get nerdy about the science of the brain, but also the emotion that emerges with it. And so as we pay attention to what we're experiencing, we can have these aha moments and go, oh, wow, I really feel the shame here. Right. And then we normalize that, because every human experiences shame. It's just part of being a human being. The skill is, how do you work with that now? Right. And how do you work with, oh, this is an experience I'm having. This does not define me. And I can find agency even when I'm feeling ashamed and guilty. Right. Or feeling like I'm terrible. I can find some agency to be able to take action, to seek an intervention that's going to support me on a journey towards healing, recovery, and ideally post-traumatic growth.
Mm-hmm. But I think the challenge is, what do you think it's going to take to get people to realize what you just discussed? Because I know in our professions, well, I'll just speak for myself, but I'm quite confident that you didn't have a different experience. These were not discussions that we had when I went into the military or in the police department or in the FBI Academy in the beginning.
Yeah.
I would say at the end of my career, I know it was being addressed at least at the National Academy where I taught it, because I created a course on it. And Susanna Hasnay had a resiliency course that she taught at the academy. So we did that. But what's interesting is that was taught to police executives. It was not even taught to FBI employees themselves. It was taught to the police executives. And, you know, so we started having those conversations, but those issues are not taught to the young recruits coming in. You know, so for me, in my case, okay, great, I got well, I got into recovery, but that was like towards the end of my career. It would have been helpful if I'd have heard about some of the stuff at the before I went into the traumatic profession. So what do you think that we can do?
Well, I think that it's a very slow shift, right? And what I think you're asking, Mike, is how do we create an evidence-based leadership culture and an evidence-based work culture that treats resilience and then treats injury, which looks like a lot of things to include addiction, treats them as predictable, normal things that happen, and then removes the judgment, removes the opportunities for shame and blame and guilt, even though those things will still happen, but we're not culturally supporting those phenomenon. Mm-hmm. We're diverting those towards actions that are going to intervene. You know, it is interesting. I think there has been a fair amount of shift of thinking in law enforcement, for example, around some of these issues. And I think in other industries as well. I think what we do is we continue to, you know, create podcasts like yours. We continue to train. We really change the narrative around life and occupational stress and trauma injury by having conversation and by doing multidisciplined, good work, right? There's so many folks, your sponsor, and you talked about Susanna and your work, the work I'm doing. So many people are doing work to really change the system, and that's going to take a very long time. But I used to be naive. I used to think, oh, we can shift police culture. And I reckoned with the reality of that, okay, that's probably not going to happen. But what I can do is I can influence one life at a time. And I think, mm-hmm. you know, maybe that's what we really need to do, is we need to impact small groups of people, and they go out and they have their experience and they can impact small groups of people. And in time, we'll create a new generation of thinking that is really benefits from the wisdom of the generations that have come and gone. And then this is a normal conversation. And then, you know, 20 years from now, they're talking about, you know, how do we shift to the next thing, right? How do we continue the evolution of health and wellness and performance?
Yeah, well, and you mentioned also, and I know in the recovery world, you know, which is the space I work in, I have seen more relapses or people that need to come to treatment. The treatment center that I'm working at right now has a waiting list to get into it. And many of the people that are coming into the treatment center are people that had some length of recovery prior to relapsing and having to come back. And the vast majority of them say that the lockdowns and the pandemic contributed to their relapses. And then, of course, suicide. Suicides have really jumped. Maybe talk about that a little bit. And you know, what is it? What can people do during the period that we're in right now? And by the way, there's no end in sight that I'm aware of. It looks like we're going to be in this predicament for quite a while. But I know in the recovery world, this last year, and this is not really a topic that many people are even talking about, but it's been devastating to the recovery community and the mental health community. What can we do?
Yeah,
what would you recommend during this period?
Yeah, there's the first thing I want to say is kind of to go back to your last question, and you know, what can we do broadly? Mike, we need to educate ourselves about addiction.
Yeah,
you know, it's so interesting to me. You know, I think it's, I might be wrong, but I think it's New York City that's opened up these centers where they're facilitating people so they can use, say, heroin. Right, they have clean needles, safe mm-hmm. space. They're there to respond to, you know, overdose and, you know, provide naloxone or whatever. And the response to that, understandably, the response to that in so many places in America is, oh, we can't do that, you know. And yet, if you understand addiction and you look at some models around the world of how we're responding to addiction, it may make more sense, right? And I'm not necessarily advocating we all need to go to that model. However, we reject it with emotion grounded in a very limited experience around our understanding of addiction. So I would say that to understand why are relapses increasing? Why are people moved more towards substance abuse, alcohol misuse during the pandemic? To understand addiction, to open your mind and really try to understand things better, because it's not as simple as those of us who aren't directly impacted by addiction often feel, or even if we are, we often come back to this really linear, hard-lined approach to, well, if it's a problem, Mike, just quit, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's not that easy. Yeah. And it's not that simple. And there's scientific reasons for it. And there's wisdom there that I think we need to cultivate so we can have intelligent conversations about addiction. So that's the first thing I'd say. The other thing I would go to is, I had a conversation this week with a friend of mine, Kyle, who's a sergeant with the sheriff's office in California. And he has this beautiful four pillars of wellness. And he says, movement, right? So movement. So I would say, move your body, take a walk. You know, you don't have to go to the gym to be physically healthy. And I know all the gym owners now are mad at me, but you can just simply find a way to regularly move your body. You know, take a walk several times a week for a half hour, or take a walk every day for 15 minutes, or, you know, move the body. Pay attention to your nutrition. Now, I don't have a prescription for what nutrition should look like, but pay attention to the foods you eat. Eat as healthy as you can. and you know, do research around that, because there's plenty of good info out there. The third thing is sleep. Dedicate an effort to sleep well. And I know that's hard. If you have trouble with sleeping, you're going to have trouble with sleeping. That's just, that's how it is, right? So I'm not saying, oh, well, just put dark curtains up and you'll sleep fine, because that's offensive. But work on sleep. And that means maybe for all of these things, for nutrition, for sleep, and for movement, you may need an interventionist, as we say in the academic world. You might need to go to your medical doc and work through sleep issues. You might need to go to your psychotherapist and work with sleep issues. You know, you might need to go to that YouTube channel for that yoga training and use that to help you do movement. Movement, nutrition, sleep, and the fourth pillar that Kyle has is mindfulness. And it's so simple. These four pillars, there's so much room to play with that. But while we're in this pandemic, you know, I think these four pillars are critical. And I would add a fifth, and that's sort of the social fitness. Mm-hmm. Stay connected to people. Get on the phone, talk to your friends, you know, or whatever. You can tell I'm an old guy, I see the phone, what's that, right? Stay connected to people. And that doesn't mean hours of mind-numbing scrolling through Instagram, right? It means some kind of meaningful connection with other humans on some kind of regular basis, so that you feel connected. Because what we know about the wisdom and science of the human experience is that we need connection. And, you know, and this goes back to why we don't seek, why we infer our trauma injuries, which, you know, look like sometimes addiction, is because we so desperately want connection, and we fear a disconnect from our tribe if we come out, right? We fear a disconnect from the people who love us if we are vulnerable and transparent about the challenges that we're facing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, fortunately, depending how you look at it, rarely does our tribe, you know, let us go. You know what I mean? Like, our people will support us. You know, they may struggle at first, but our people generally will support us if we can be authentic.
You know, I will tell you that in my own personal experience, I really thought that when I came into recovery, that was going to be it, that I would be the black sheep, that, you know, I'd be the person, you know, shunned over into the corner. Actually, nothing could be further from the truth. I actually can't think of anyone in my world that shunned me. And in fact, the help was overwhelming and the support was overwhelming. It doesn't mean that everybody understood it. It doesn't mean that everyone knew what to do or what they tried to do was helpful. But no, there was no ill intent on anyone's part. It was just maybe not, like as you said, maybe not understanding what was going on. But it was really nice to see that most people were very, very supportive and wanted to be supportive. I know if you're listening to this podcast and you're struggling with addiction, I ask this question all the time. And the question is this: raise your hand if you don't know, if you are, you know, either, let me look at some categories here. How many people out there are struggling with addiction issues themselves, whether it's a chemical addiction or a process addiction, or you know someone or work with someone or for someone that has an addiction issue? And I've never had somebody not raise their hand in groups that I've talked to. It is such a universal issue. Everybody struggles with it. You know, they want you to, the people that know you and love you want you to be well. That's all they want, is for you to be well. And I was really surprised at how much support there was out there. And I think that spans across a lot of different issues, mental health issues, physical issues. It just was not my experience that people were not supportive. And I'll tell you, but if you did run into someone that was not supportive of you, I'm not really sure how much of a friend they were in the first place. So I think we all, there's a lot more compassion than people think. So I'm not sure if that's something that you would agree with.
Yes, I would. And I think that, you know, it's funny. Life is complex and it's challenging. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, I think there's this sort of superficial way that you know, Western life often gets packaged, you know, and it's all the marketing messages, and that pervades into relationships. And, you know, we want to present ourselves as being totally squared away, you know, totally healthy. I got everything going on for me, right? You know, I'm successful and all of that. And I think that we spend a lot of our time and a lot of our energy trying to maintain our image, right? To maintain the attachment to how we believe others see us and how we want others to see us. And that's a lot of energy that is probably better used elsewhere. And so part of, I think, reckoning with self-development and growth and working through, you know, issues that we may all face is reckoning with sort of that attachment. And, you know, coming back to mindfulness, part of what we're teaching is how to notice that attachment to ego, for example, and how to work with ego. And not that ego is it's not a negative thing at all. However, we can get wrapped around our attachment to that sense of how others see us. And what I try to do is encourage people to cultivate your sense of self. So for internally out rather than externally in, and to really work with, you know, how do I want to be? How do I want to show up in the world? And to focus on, you know, really behavioral efforts that get us to that effort of showing up in the world, and then working on the narrative of how we see ourselves, not the narrative of how we think other people see us. Because frankly, that will probably, you know, in the long run, drive us mad a little bit, to try to always make other people happy. You know, I joke sometimes, and I'm not sure I'm really joking, but I think we're all like seventh graders living in an adult bodies. You know, like, are you wearing the right clothes, you know, or do you like the right music? And I mean, all this just bullshit stuff that started when we were young, because that's how we were socialized. It continues to the adult world. And, you know, even within, you know, our law enforcement professions, our time in the military, there's a lot of that, right? It's like, oh, you know, look at me, look how awesome I am. And at the end of the day, none of us are really, you know, we're all just people. And we'd be healthier, we'd perform better as teams if we could just show up skillfully with authenticity, with compassion, and what I like to call the badass skills of our tradecraft, which are supported by authenticity and humanity.
You know, and if you're, now there's a lot of professions where ego drives what you do. Nothing is more pronounced than the military and police forces and the FBI, that's for sure. I mean, when you look at step one of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life has become unmanageable. You know, powerlessness, unmanageability. Unmanageability, we get. Powerlessness, yeah, not so much. You know, these are professions where, you know, we don't have powerlessness. We're trained to adapt, overcome. You know, you come to me with problems, I don't go to you with problems. You know, we're the solvers of the community. And that's great in that profession. If you're an infantry officer, that's great. If you're a military pilot, that's great. If you're a police officer, that's great. If you're an addict, that's a death sentence. Because not realizing that you're powerless over this thing that has consumed your life, and the thought that you can just take care of this yourself without any help from others, that is a death sentence. Now, again, there's a lot of professions that that may apply to: doctors, lawyers, you know, people that are in all kinds of professions where, you know, self-resilient, you know, resiliency and confidence comes into play. But that can be very, very difficult if you don't come to that realization that, you know, there's times when we need to reach out for help. And if it's something that you're struggling, if you're struggling with mental health issues or addiction issues, it's really advisable that you reach out for help, because you're not going to overcome this by yourself. In fact, there really aren't many issues in our life, I don't believe, and I'll get your opinion on this. There aren't many issues that we deal with where it's solely us that comes to that resolution of those problems. And so part of resiliency is knowing how and when and where to reach out for help, isn't it?
I think so. And I think that, you know, it's funny. I think one of the great delusions that so many of us hold is that we're successful in our own right. You know, like, I'll go back to my Coast Guard career. You know, I spent, I don't know, 6 or so years in active duty and 21 or so, you know, on the reserve side of the house. And, you know, retired at a rank as a baby junior or a baby senior officer, as I like to say, as a Coast Guard commander. And I was successful because of the people around me. Yeah, I put in work, I put in effort, but there were people who mentored me, people who, you know, worked for me, worked alongside me, that contributed to my success. You know, my family, my wife contributed to my success, you know, and there's so much of that. And I think that we might be more willing to accept that reality than the reality that, we also need similar support to work through the difficulty, not just the success, right? And so I like to frame, I don't often use, in context of training law enforcement, I don't often use the term seeking help. I make it more clinical. I say you need interventions in your life to achieve optimal health, optimal humanity, and to optimize your capacity for performance. And sometimes that intervention is recognizing an addiction habit and then going to your medical professional and working through that. And, you know, sometimes it's recognizing other kinds of trauma injuries from life and from the occupation, and then reaching out to an interventionist, to a psychotherapist or a coach or, you know, your medical professional or someone in that area of specialty to work through whatever it is that you've recognized within yourself. And it's a must. You know, we are not engineered as human beings to do anything alone. And in fact, when we try, if we don't fail recognizably, biologically, we start to fail. So people who are not connected to other humans are not as healthy as people who are connected to other humans.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And that's why this last year, maybe even 2 years, has just been devastating for us, for all of us, because we are losing that sense of community in being with one another, that connectedness. And so we have to work so much harder to maintain that connectedness, because it just isn't easy these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we're learning new vocabulary and new skills around how to talk about that. I think Adam Grant recently wrote a piece in New York Times about this notion of languishing. You know, it's just common, like, hey, you know, how do we show, hey, Mike, how you doing? Hey, Rich, how you doing? And we don't know how to answer that, right? Yeah. It's like, and so Adam Grant's trying to encourage us, I think, if I understand what he's writing, is to be able to just describe it. Yeah, dude, I'm good, but I'm just languishing in this pandemic. I just don't feel all present. I don't, you know, like, it's hard, right? And to be able to describe what we're experiencing, even in pandemic, as a way of socially connecting is important, because what do we really gain? You know, and I'm guilty of this too. You know, this morning I had a number of phone calls, and, you know, it's the classic, hey, how you doing? Oh, I'm good. You know, like, nah, I'm actually not, you know, like I'm not in crisis, but, you know, yeah, it kind of sucks right now. Right. Cause what I really want to do is to be able to travel and work with groups of people, but I'm not doing that in January because of COVID, and, you know, and that really sucks. Right. Mm-hmm. So not that I need to, you know, spend 20 minutes, you know, telling this person on the other end of the phone call, you know, all of my sadness, but maybe there's a way to connect in a little more authentically. I mean, I don't know. But learning how to connect in this new environment when, you know, you said we have to try really hard. Yeah, we do. And I'm not so sure that we're really skillful at that yet. I know I'm not.
No, we're not. We're not. And, well, you know, the training that you're doing is going a long way to help destigmatize all of this that we're talking about. And so tell us a little bit more about what you have planned for this year. And for any of the listeners that want to contact you, maybe schedule you, talk with you, make arrangements with you, how would they go about doing that?
Yes. So thank you for that opportunity, Mike. Mindfulbadge.com, mindfulbadge.com. That's my website. You can reach me there. You should be able to find me pretty simply. Email richard@mindfulbadge.com. And Yeah, doing a lot of training, spending a lot of time in West Virginia, and then doing some training on the West Coast as well. And I work with, you know, primarily first responder clients, but I also have done a fair amount of work with other organizations. So yeah, if you're interested in chatting about mindfulness training, I'm always happy to talk. And the nice thing too is that if my team's not a good fit, we're all connected in the mindfulness training community, and I can refer you to places that might be a good fit for what you're trying to do.
Absolutely. And the same goes well as well. If you forget all of that, just reach out to me on my website and I can hook you up with Rich. Or also, we did talk about Susanna Hasney and her, again, if you want to go back and revisit her podcast, she's on there, and she is the president of PoliceSpirit.com, or Police Spirit is the name of her company, and you can go to PoliceSpirit.com and check out her website as well. And she and Rich do a lot of work together. So what do you, so you and Susanna work together. Can you describe to our audience what it is that you guys do?
Yeah, so we're part of a team of trainers that trains an FBI program called PEAK, P-E-A-K, and it's designed to deliver psychoeducation and mind-body skills to a variety of components within the FBI. And right now, it's primarily the tactical teams throughout the U.S. So we spend a fair amount of time traveling to various places and training teams in mindfulness and in yoga, in breath work, and some other psychoeducation, in an effort to improve their health and well-being, to improve their social performance, right, their humanity, and to improve their capacity to move into flow state, to move into those, you know, those times when they really need to optimize. And we've been doing this for several years, and it's a lot of fun to train with really smart, capable people, and it's really necessary work. You know, it's funny, and you know, Mike, we often think of, you know, FBI agents as having it all together, and in many ways they do, and they're human, right? And the stressors of the job are just so incredible. And I'm not sure that, you know, most listeners who, you know, maybe aren't in federal government or maybe don't pay attention to what the FBI does, but the tempo of work for most FBI personnel, not just agents, is pretty intense. And, you know, so we are providing skills and training to support them to stay healthy, to be able to go home, to whatever home looks like, but to have, you know, healthy home lives, and you know, to be able to go to Starbucks, for example, and order your coffee, and when the barista, forgive me, Starbucks, but when the barista gets the order wrong, which sometimes happens in life, not for that to be the end of the world because we're so reactive, right? And that's one signal of peak stress is just how reactive we can be in the world. And so we have fun conversations around reactivity, and how we learn to untrain reactivity. So,
well, it sounds like a lot of fun. And yeah, and I absolutely can attest to the stressful lifestyle. You know, that's where I spent 21 years of my life. So I can absolutely attest to
right.
that. And I'm so glad that you're doing the work that you're doing, because that's, I never received any training like that, and it would have been very useful. So very, very important work, and I appreciate you doing that. And thanks again for joining us. So, Rich Gerling, guys, thank you for being on the show. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. Yeah, great to be here with you. Appreciate the work you're doing.
Oh, not a problem. And so, again, folks, this episode has been sponsored by FHE Health. And according to SAMHSA, first responders are 30% more likely to develop behavioral health conditions like PTSD. FHE Health specializes in getting first responders better and cleared for duty. So find out more at FHEhealth.com. And guys, as I always like to say, I don't represent any group. I do not represent anyone other than myself. My only purpose in giving this information and what Rich is sharing is we're doing this to see if, you know, if it can help you, great. If not, leave anything that you don't agree with behind, but anything that you can use, take that and try to help someone else, because that's what we do in recovery. We help ourselves while we're trying to help others. And so with that, please visit our Facebook page, which is Recovery is Possible, and our website, VanMeterWellnessSolutions.com. let me know how I'm doing, and let me know if there's any topic that you'd like to hear about, because I'd love to hear from you. So take care, and guys, we will see you next time. Thanks for joining us.